WK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The largest healthcare strike in American history is underway. Tens of thousands of Kaiser Permanente workers have walked off the job. CBS's Jolene Kent reports.
At dawn, more than 75,000 workers at Kaiser Permanente walked out.
We're taking care of lives. You know, healthcare workers should be valued.
Joining her on the picket lines, pharmacists, respiratory therapists, optometrists, and other technicians. The union is asking for better working conditions and a $25 an hour minimum wage. Kaiser has offered $21 to $23 an hour. That's just above what fast food workers will soon make in California.
After House lawmakers voted out their speaker, Kevin McCarthy, President Biden says,
"More than anything, we need to change the poisonous atmosphere in Washington. You know, we have strong disagreements, but we need to stop seeing each other as enemies. We need to talk to one another, listen to one another, work with one another."
Congressman Steve Scalise and Jim Jordan are running for the position. CBS's Scott McFarlane heard from Republican New York Congressman Mike Lawler.
The interim speaker, North Carolina's Patrick McHenry, had no answers on the days ahead. The only certainty among most Republicans, their disdain for colleague Matt Gaetz, who led the charge to remove McCarthy.
I think it was deplorable. I think it was disgraceful. And he put his own petty personal grievances ahead of the country.
Gaetz continued to attack his colleagues.
Senator Dianne Feinstein's memorial service tomorrow will be still held outside San Francisco City Hall, but it's no longer open to the public due to security issues. The senator, who died last week at age 90, lied in state today. KCBS's Mike DeWall.
The flag-draped casket arrived at San Francisco City Hall by motorcade and was received by Mayor London Breed, flanked by an honor guard, city staff, and Feinstein's friends and family.
All uniformed personnel, present!
Inside, a string quartet provided the soundtrack. San Francisco leaders all paying their respects. One by one, mourners stepped up to the casket, like Carolyn McKenna.
She did so many great things for the city and the country. I just had to pay my respects.
Mike DeWald for CBS News, San Francisco.
The man accused of being the mastermind in rapper Tupac Shakur's 1996 murder appears in a Las Vegas courtroom on murder charges. CBS's Elise Preston was at the courthouse.
After Tupac Shakur's murder 27 years ago, the focus was on this Las Vegas courtroom as a handcuffed Dwayne Keefe D. Davis limped in, appearing before a judge and the world for the first time since the self-proclaimed gang member and drug kingpin was charged with Tupac's murder.
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. A Waukesha County judge has ruled against a school district's policy that allowed students to change their name and gender pronouns without parental consent. The decision by Judge Michael Maxwell determined that the Kettle Moraine School District's policy infringed upon parents' rights to make medical decisions for their children. The ruling follows a lawsuit filed by the parents 2 years ago. An area veterinary clinic is resuming plans for a new pet hospital in Pewaukee, near its existing Waukesha location. A previous attempt from the Wisconsin Veterinary Referral Center was halted 4 years ago. The proposed facility would be about 25,000 square feet. The new hospital will operate 24/7, offering emergency and specialized pet care services. The Pewaukee Common Council approved the facility this week. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today marks the 50th anniversary, and I don't want to mark this positively, because this has been horribly destructive for democracy, horribly destructive for working people. You know, every bit of the No Rights at Work agenda comes out of this one organization. They're called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, brought up back in the 70s. It's one of those things that sprung out of the Heritage Foundation, you know, big money, you know, rich people going, hey, how do we save free enterprise, you know, from those unions and those workers and those people? Well, they created these institutions who come up with bad ideas, and every bad idea that's harmed working people, ALEC has been behind. So here to mark 50 years of harm, I've asked Vicki Harrison to come talk with us. Vicki is the Director of Constitutional Convention and Protecting Dissent Programs at our good friends at Common Cause. Vicki, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
50 years of harm. I mean, I can't even wrap my mind around how much damage this organization has done over 50 years. And for the vast majority of those 50 years, nobody knew who they were. This has just been the last 10 or 15 years that people actually get an idea of who they are and how bad they are.
They're awful. And you're absolutely right, Rick. ALEC started 50 years ago. They celebrated their 50th anniversary in DC tonight with a gala at the National Portrait Gallery. And what ALEC has been doing for 50 years is creating really bad model policy laws that large corporations, big money donors, are pushing through. And then they meet with state legislators who then take these bad policies back to their states, pretend like it's something they came up with to help their community. And not only is it allowing these companies to make money, because there's a fiscal aspect to a lot of the bills. I mean, why else are you going to try to pass a bill? Why are you going to spend money? But they are serious threats to workers, our environment, racial justice, the vitality of our democracy. I say your listeners can think of any bad bill that has passed for the common good in the last 50 years, and it will have ALEC's fingerprints on it.
Yeah, give me a couple of examples. You know, here in my state of Pennsylvania, they were behind a bad, horrible unemployment destruction bill. They've been behind a lot of the destruction of prevailing wage laws. They've been, you name it, they've been behind it. But give us some examples so that maybe people have a tangible idea of what we're talking about.
Okay, so Rick, let's start with for workers. I mean, the big one, right to work. I mean, that is a model ALEC bill that they have pushed in nearly half of our states now. We've got this thing called the Paycheck Protection Act, which, again, many unions permit dues to be directly deducted from the paychecks, just the way insurance premiums are withheld. This model legislation would prohibit that.
Yeah, I love that name, though. I love that name.
All of them are like that, Rick.
I love the messaging behind it, though, because it's so not what it is. Because wage theft is still perfectly okay. They're not fighting against wage theft. In fact, you know, they're promoting, you know, committing wage theft. But paycheck protection is protecting you from, well, from your union fighting for better wages, hours, and conditions. It's really brilliant if you think about it.
Well, they do that all over the place. I mean, when we want to talk about, you know, protecting big polluters, they have the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. Okay, wow, we want to make sure that our infrastructure is safe. No, that bill calls for increased penalties for civil disobedience. It says that if you're protesting at a pipeline or anything that has an interest for fossil fuels, you can have felony charges. You can have fines. You can go to prison. And they, you know, voter ID laws, they've tried to distance themselves from that. The Stand Your Ground law, you know, I tell people that was not an original ALEC bill. But once Florida passed that bill, they're like, hey, let's jump on this. And then they spread it to 22 other states. Whether we're talking about the environment, whether we're talking about stopping the right to protest, which is in the First Amendment, workers' rights, local democracy, you know, doing everything they can to make sure that local governments can't pass laws. You know, this whole preemption idea that everything should be done at the state level and God forbid a city council pass a bill that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, what's amazing to me is, yeah, I remember the first time I learned about ALEC, because there were some really bad unemployment insurance bills popping up, and they all seemed to look alike. They all had the same ideas, the same verbiage. They all followed the same flow. It was remarkable how multiple legislators could have the identical same piece of. In fact, my congressman, Scott Perry, at the time was one of the people who turned in someone else's homework, I believe. Because I had actually asked him about it back then. And that's when I really found out about ALEC. And then, you know, basically just handing out model legislation that legislators across the country would then turn in as their own homework, hoping no one would notice.
Hoping no one would notice. And again, they're passing these bills so the sponsors, the corporations who are on these task force creating this model legislation with state legislators who then vote on it at these conferences, they are monetarily benefiting from many of these bills. And that is what is so frustrating for me, Rick, because, you know, at Common Cause, look, I love me a model bill, okay? I mean, there is nothing wrong with a model bill on same-day registration or how to do early voting the right way or how to not gerrymander my state. We have model bills. We lobby for them. We are proud to lobby for them. But what we do that ALEC doesn't do is we register to lobby. We report our lobbying activities. We use C4 money for that, whereas they continue to say they don't do any lobbying. They just educate. So therefore, they don't have to follow any lobby rules. And then the final thing is at Common Cause, we don't monetarily benefit when people stop gerrymandering their state. And that is what is so frustrating about ALEC. Not only are there bills that they are passing horrible for the American people, they're also just blowing through all the rules that the rest of us are following.
Now, you said that they just educate. Where do they do this education? You know, when legislators this education, where does this education generally happen?
Well, it's usually in a beach town, I will say that. There's a lot of cigar bars thrown in and whiskey nights, and they have resorts. And, you know, what used to happen, so you had mentioned this earlier, how we didn't know anything about ALEC for many years, and 10, 15 years ago. Well, there was a whistleblower that went to Lisa Graves at the Center for Media and Democracy and dumped nearly 1,000 model bills. And if your listeners have not watched Bill Moyers, United States of Alec from a decade ago, I highly suggest it. It is very informative. And that was the first time we in this community, Center is one of my partners, and that we ever knew how big they reached and how much they worked on. And so what they used to do was they had corporations spend a bunch of money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to be a member, and a legislator would pay $100 for a two-year membership. So corporations were right there. The lobbyists for the corporations are hanging out at these resorts with legislators from around the country. Well, once we found out their breadth of it, we and many partners pushed all these corporations to leave ALEC. And to date, we've had about 125 of them leave ALEC. And instead of having those corporate memberships, they're now getting sketchy, Rick. They're just having people, you know, sponsor an event or be a contributor or sit on a board. In fact, we just got released this week, all of their sponsors and committee members and host for their big event they held tonight. And again, very surprising. We and our partners are starting a petition tomorrow to once again dump ALEC. And we are going to be asking everybody who is listed in any invitation tonight, not only their presidents and CEOs, but their entire board of directors, will find out about them spending money at ALEC and that it's not appropriate.
No, I'm right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Vicki Harrison. Vicki is the director of Constitutional Convention and Protecting Dissent Programs at Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website if you want to check out the work that they do. If you want to know more about ALEC, alecexposed.org is the website. We'll get links on social media on both of those so you can check out all of that stuff. Now, what's interesting is right now we're now seeing, you know, all of these groups that have been around for decades that have been doing back, you know, back alley, back room, you know, smoky back room work. You've got ALEC, you've got the Heritage Foundation, the State Policy Network, Federalist Society. You've got all of these big money groups doing the work of the billionaire class and the wealth class in corporate America. And I don't know that the working class of this country, that working people, quite get how intertwined these moneyed interests are. And it does, for me, explain why when we want to get something like an increase in the minimum wage, which hasn't happened in, 14 years now, it doesn't happen. Why when we want to make sure that we protect unemployment insurance or workers' comp or whatever, it doesn't seem to happen. What we want and need doesn't seem to get done. But what corporate America and our billionaire class wants, they're on it in a heartbeat. This kind of explains it, doesn't it?
It absolutely explains it. And everybody you just mentioned is, of course, a sponsor for the gala that they held tonight. You've got State Policy Network on there. You've got the Heritage Foundation. You've got, you know, Prosperity. You've got them all on there. And again, people don't spend money and decades of work expecting nothing in return.
No, as my grandfather always said, if a rich guy takes a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because he understands return on investment. And these people do. And what's amazing to me, Vicki, is how cheap, how little they spend to get so much. I mean, that's the part that's just really offensive to me.
It's very offensive. And, you know, it's even more insidious because they continue to insist that they're only doing outreach and education and not lobbying. So all the legislators who go to their junkets, do they even have to report that under their lobbying laws, under their financial disclosures? I mean, again, these are people that want regular Americans out of the process, period. And, you know, in fact, when ALEC was founded, the same guy who founded the Heritage Foundation, Paul Weyrich, I mean, we've all heard this quote of his that we don't want people to vote. And if, in case your folks have not heard it, he literally said, I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of the people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And what's interesting about that quote, what's interesting about that quote is he's talking to 20,000 Baptist ministers. So you're taking this kind of fascistic kind of financial dominance and putting it with religion and telling religious leaders this stuff. And again, you know, 1980 was a long time ago, but not for this message. This is how we got here. So we got where we are now.
That's how we got here. And again, the prior to that quote in that speech, you know, he makes fun of good government. You know, he calls it the goo-goo. There's too many of y'all out there trying to do what I call the goo-goo, good government. And I just think, you know, as an organization that is founded after Watergate for good government and holding power accountable, it's just offensive to have these guys in what they think are behind their closed doors, saying all the quiet stuff really, really loud.
Yeah, they don't care anymore because it's almost okay now because we've allowed for obscene wealth. Whereas, you know, back then you still had a high top marginal tax rate. We were still kind of taxing people at a higher rate.
It was still a middle class.
And you still had a middle class of working people who were saying, hey, we don't want an Elon Musk or a Jeff Bezos. We don't want the kind of obscene wealth that would allow for this kind of stuff. So your last line of questioning, you know, with this anniversary, you know, and I don't want to mark this positively, what should average everyday working people be doing? How do we combat the kind of damage that they do? You know, what's your hope moving forward?
My hope is always, Rick, that everybody will talk to their legislators, your state senator and your state representative, and let them know this is what is happening. Get involved with any of the organizations, whether it's, you know, labor, Greenpeace, Common Cause, People for the American Way, Union of Concerned Scientists, Center for Media and Democracy. There are dozens of us that are working to stop these harmful policies. And the only reason a lot of times they get through is because nobody knows. They want the secrecy, which is why, you know, I wanted our hashtag to be, you know, like a fence. I wanted to be like, I'm watching your little so-and-so, okay? We are not stopping. We are paying attention to you. And that's what your listeners can do. Reach out. Think whatever issue is important to you, put that issue in your browser and then put ALEC, and you will find something. You will find an organization that is actively trying to stop them because they're coming for us in the 2024 session, whether it's workers, anti-ESG, stopping the right to boycott. I mean, there is a lot going on. And that's why this week we highlighted all of that. We started the week with a showing of a film called Boycott, one of the best documentaries I've seen in a long time. This is a piece of legislation they've been passing where if you want to do business with the state, in your contract, it literally says, I will not boycott Israel. Even if you have nothing to do with Israel. And this is something Alex started pushing. And this film called Boycott from Just Vision is fantastic. It follows three plaintiffs. And today we were talking to the publisher and founder of the Arkansas Times, who lost all of his state contracts for advertising because he refused to sign this. He's like, what do I have to do with Israel? I'm a publisher in Arkansas. And think about that, Rick. They could remove that word Israel and put anything they wanted to in there.
No, that's scary.
And it's already passed in dozens of states.
That is scary. Vicki, I appreciate the time, the information. Good stuff. I hope you'll keep us informed on what's going on. I wish you the best for throughout the action week. Folks want to learn more, alecexposed.org, the website. You want to know more about Common Cause, commoncause.org. Vicki Harrison, appreciate the time.
Thank you so much, Rick. Have a great evening.
You as well. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We
are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, I look at Alec, and again, you know, this is not new. You know, none of this stuff is surprising. None of it's new. We know who Alec is. We know what they do. And a lot of this comes down to you've got a lot of very, very wealthy people who want to make more. They want more power. They want more control. They want more. That's it. More. It's that simple. Just more. And we as working people never seem to get the things that we need. They get everything they want. We don't seem to get the things that we need. And that's, you know, that's angering to me on a whole bunch of levels. But you know, here's the thing that gets me. You know, I was saying earlier that, you know, Republicans just seem to lie a little differently these days. You know, in the old days, there had to be at least some kernel of truth, some bit of reality, something. There had to be something there. And I came across this clip of an Ohio State representative. Her name is Beth Lear. A Republican in the state of Ohio, in the state house there. She's the co-author of a anti-trans bathroom bill. And it's look, we can debate over that if we have to. But it's this kind of stuff that is kind of is completely outrageous. She's I'm just gonna play what she had to say, because it really is quite, this is one of those moments. It reminds me of the when we went to Iraq the first time, and you got the candy striper who said, you know, she was in Kuwait, and she was a candy striper, and the Iraqi soldiers were throwing babies out of incubators and bayoneting them on the ground, and you know, the whole country was outraged. And but eventually we found out it was total bunk. It was complete BS. This kind of stuff, here's the representative. Listen to this.
I happen to know a young lady who was tragically raped by multiple members of an athletic team. And because of that, she decided to transition. She was not allowed to consider, because our mental health situation doesn't allow it, but that's not for this bill. She was not allowed to consider the tragedy that was that rape. What she was encouraged to do was, if you're uncomfortable in your body, you should change it. And she's gone through a transition because she's afraid of men.
She's afraid of men. Now, here's the problem. That's a horrible story. Oh my God. You know, someone, you know, brutally raped and all the horrible story. Problem is, there is not one shred of evidence that it ever took place. This is the kind of stuff that gets me. We're just now making stuff up. It's alternative facts, alternative reality, because there's got to be somebody out there, right? Something like this had to happen somewhere in a country of 325 million people, right? And, you know, I'm watching the video and I'm looking at the guy standing next to her, and the guy standing next to her is kind of like going, what are you talking about? The look on his face is like, oh my God, why am I standing here? I am now going to be part of this picture of, are you kidding me? That's the way it looked. But here's the part that I'm struggling with. Because, again, the alternative reality. You know, there was somehow in a bathroom raped by, you know, multiple people. I think I'm supposed to believe that it was, you know, people who were, you know, maybe trans, I'm not sure. Because it's a trans bathroom bill, so it's kind of, I think that's what it's supposed to be. But it was, I guess, I don't even know. And are there multiple people who are in this? Because she said multiple times. And then the kicker was she was forcibly transitioned. She then forcibly trans. You go, what? Wait, forcibly? Someone made her? And this plays into all of the right-wing lunacy. That there's all of this stuff going on that, you know, all of these people are, you know, are transitioning and they're raping people in bathrooms, happening everywhere. And then, you know, they're going to make you transition, which is crazy. But it's the alternative reality that they're selling. It's the alternative facts that they keep throwing out. And again, like I've been saying, Republicans just seem to lie a little differently than they used to. They lied a lot before, but at least there was, I don't know, something close to reality. I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of reality. Now we're just making you know what up. I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of that? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the evening that a series of explosions began at the T.A. Gillespie Company near Morgan, New Jersey. The explosions would destroy the plant and 300 buildings and kill an estimated 100 people. The world was embroiled in World War I. The United States had entered the global conflict the year before. The nation's factories were churning out munitions and other supplies for the war effort. On that fateful evening at Gillespie, workers were loading shells at the sprawling complex of 700 buildings that covered more than 2,000 acres. The initial explosion was likely an accident. Regardless, the explosion was so severe that it cut water lines to that part of the plant. Without water pressure, firefighters struggled to douse the flames. A chain reaction of explosions touched off as the fire spread in the plant. Houses in the nearby town shook from the massive explosions. Windows exploded and residents fled. Residents from three towns were evacuated due to the disaster. The New York Sun described the exodus as, quote, streams of human misery, mothers and fathers, frightened children clutching still more frightened dogs, old people tottering along with all the same dazed expressions on their faces, as if they scarcely realized what had happened. When the fire was finally put out, nearly half of the plant's buildings were destroyed. It was impossible to say exactly how many workers were killed, so bad was the carnage. Two members of the U.S. Coast Guard died responding to the disaster. The disaster was then compounded when a flu epidemic swept through the residents evacuated from nearby towns. The death toll and misery from these tragic events mounted even higher. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
In the mid-1800s, a new political party flared up in America, posing as an alternative to both the Democratic and Republican parties. Xenophobic and nativist, it was extremely secretive about its specific structure, motive, and agenda. Indeed, members were instructed to say, "I know nothing," when asked about details. Thus, it was quickly dubbed the Know Nothing Party. In 1856, it nominated Millard Fillmore as its presidential nominee, but he was reticent to talk about the party and even unwilling to proclaim that he was a member. He lost, and the Know-Nothing soon withered. But now, here comes another alternative party with secretive motives and backers. Labeling themselves No Labels, this group ought to be named the Nothing Party, for it offers nothing of substance to voters. Its so-called common-sense agenda is fluffier than cotton candy, yet is trying to run a third-party candidate in next year's presidential race. Why? Follow the money. That's not easy to do, though, for this gaggle of conservative corporatists slyly incorporated as a nonprofit social welfare outfit, a deceit that lets it hide the names of its political funders from the public. The New Republic, however, got records revealing that No Labels is a fat cat front, with Texas billionaire Republican Harlan Crow leading the way. Who? Crow is the political patron who has secretly been lavishing luxury gifts and cash on Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who in turn has embraced Crow's plutocratic positions in court cases. This is Jim Hightower saying that same plutocratic agenda appears to be fueling No Label's third-party presidential push. For these rich politicos know that a milquetoast spoiler candidate would most likely draw independent moderates from Joe Biden, giving Crow and company another GOP corporate presidency. It's a cynical game, but that's how they play it.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things we talk about quite often on the program is, conditions at work. For years, I've talked about a friend of mine who's blind and the struggles that he has getting a job, even though I got to tell you, the guy's Superman. He can fix anything. In fact, whenever I need something mechanical, I need information, I just call him. And he literally walks me through every step of the process. He's blind. He cannot see anything, but he tore my engine apart, put it back together. This is a guy who has incredible skills, but a lot of employers not even going to give him a chance. I'm here to share some thoughts on maybe how we change some of that, how we address some of that. I've asked Julie Metro to come talk with us. She's a fellow over at Mother Jones. She's got an article out right now for disabled workers. Discrimination is common if you even get to apply. Julia, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. And October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month. Awareness is great, but when we look at data, blind people and other people with disabilities are employed at much lower rates than people without disabilities. And that is extremely frustrating considering there has been legislation which ideally should have prevented this that are decades old. I should say the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and the American with Disabilities Act of 1990. So what is the problem? What I think and what some other people think is that there are systemic ableism issues with hiring, and for blind people, how that can show up is corporations not testing their hiring portals. So for example, on Workday or Greenhouse, if they have something where something needs to be uploaded, they don't check to make sure that a screen reader, which is a device that reads text and also automation, for example, telling you to upload your resume aloud, when it's not checked and that's not being part of the system, that can lead to issues that blind people face with applying.
Now, in your story, you actually talk about someone who went blind later in life, but actually wrote programs that he then tried to use and couldn't access the things that even he wrote after he went blind, which I found kind of interesting.
Yeah. So Marco, one of the persons I had talked to, he had worked at a very successful startup in San Francisco. They said there was a full-time position open. He set out to apply. He went to the job description, which he also helped write, which is why it's so infuriating. And then he went to kind of the next step, and it was the section where you upload a resume. His screen reader could not tell what was there because the kind of like the functions in the background didn't have the right cue. So he had to get his wife to help him. And why that is a problem is that blind people and other people with disabilities deserve autonomy. Blind people can work on their own, but that means companies' software and their websites and all that need to follow guidelines set out by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is actually not that complicated. And also, there are a lot of places, such as I highlighted in my article, like Job Accommodation Network, where you can access resources for free.
So what's the way forward in this? Because look, I think most people believe if you can do the job, you should be able to get the job. Mm-hmm. And if there are reasonable accommodations that can be made, that that's part of this. And like I said, my friend is highly capable, But, you know, as you've pointed out, the hiring process, not friendly to him. How can we fix that? How can we move? How can we make it easier? Is there a path forward, do you think?
Yeah, there's absolutely a path forward. And I think also, like, we're so much more online than so many years ago. Maybe not everyone is like a tech genius, but individually, corporations really need to learn best practices, and all companies can test their hiring listings with software, with screen readers, just to make sure it works. And that is a fairly easy thing to do. This shouldn't fall on blind people and other people with low vision. They really just can do better and just test. And then, yeah, and there's so many places, like I mentioned, Job Accommodation Network, which provides a lot of resources. And there's basically an endless amount of places where people can reach out for help if they don't know the best practices.
Now, you talked about two pieces of legislation, one passed in the 70s, one passed in the 90s, mm-hmm. that were supposed to address these issues. Why have they not lived up to expectations? I don't want to say they failed, but maybe that's the question. Have they failed?
The issues are with both the Rehabilitation Act which and the ADA, which have been life-changing legislation, is that enforcement of them is kind of frustrating. You can file a complaint with the EEOC, but a lot of these recourses, for example, if you're like an early career blind person, filing a complaint against a company, unfortunately, could lead to you not being hired or retaliation. Again, very illegal, but that can happen. And suing. The issue is enforcement, even with filing an EEOC complaint, can take too long. I think it really should fall on companies. Like, there's no excuse with companies who are huge and have like a major HR department to not do better. And that should really fall on them.
So are you specifically looking at just big companies? You know, because, you know, most employers are smaller, you know, mom and pops, we're told. Small business, mm-hmm. I'm told, is the driver of our economy. Does this mean that people with disabilities and blind people would be excluded from small businesses? Or are we just focusing on big, you know, corporations with huge HR departments who can, mm-hmm. you know, test these websites?
Yeah, so Title I of ADA, which points to employment, I think I'm getting this right. It's for companies with 15 people or more. Whether or not you categorize them as mom and pop, they're definitely not the size of Amazon. They have to follow these regulations. And I think the good thing about, even if you don't have the resources to pay for an external consultant, there are a lot of free online softwares where it could be just watching a video to learn more, which can make a huge difference with how you treat not only blind people, but other disabled employees and other perspectives.
So it sounds to me, and maybe this is just a difference in our way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me that you're looking for a corporate solution, whereas I would look for a more regulatory solution to where, you know, government mm-hmm. would be a partner in this and saying, look, you know, we're going to make sure that these things are tested and are mandated to be functional so that people at least have a shot instead of just the benevolence and goodwill of corporate boards and CEOs. Mm-hmm. I tend to be a little less, I tend to put a lot of less faith in corporate benevolence.
Yeah, no, that's totally understandable. And I think one issue when it comes to this not being addressed in the government too, is that there are not a lot of openly disabled and openly blind lawmakers who would lead the change. I will say that the EEOC did release guidelines in late July on how companies, big and small, should accommodate blind job applicants and employees. So there is some information out there. I guess I might be a little bit jaded just because these laws that have been life-changing that I'm pointing to are decades old. It definitely can be a partnership. And at the moment it is a partnership, but the partnership relies on someone who is discriminated against to put in a complaint or sue. And that is an unfair burden to put on someone who has been discriminated against, which can take years to go through.
No, it's it, look, I know, again, from personal experience, I've, you know, I have, you know, I have a friend who, again, who's been through this. You know, I had, you know, relatives who went through this kind of stuff. They were very, they were functional. They wanted jobs. They just couldn't get that. And it's heartbreaking to see someone who is capable, who can be productive, be thrown to the side. So as a society, you know, how do we take this on and how do we move this forward? Because I think most people think like I do. If you're able to do the job, you should be able to get a shot at doing it. If there are reasonable economic things that can be done to help, we should be getting that, absolutely. Because I believe in work. I believe that there is a therapeutic quality to work. I believe there's self-esteem that comes with that. There's a whole bunch of positives, I think. How do we move there?
I think one part of that is also recognizing that there's quite a few disabled workers who are not openly disabled out of fear of discrimination. I do think some awareness can help. I don't think this should necessarily only fall on disabled workers. I'm not 100% sure how changing laws would necessarily help. I say this out of fear because literally this week, part of the ADA is under debate at the Supreme Court. So where my brain is at is like, okay, we're going to go backwards anyway. So I'm a bit, I hope not.
This is where I was going to take this eventually, because there is a push to take us backwards. We seem to be moving towards an authoritarian kind of rule where, you know, gays and lesbians and people with disabilities and the others will be shunned to the side. This is one of these things where the hope is now's the time to come out and be forceful in this stuff, much more forceful than just asking for benevolence.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think that there are very easy ways to see this. And I can say it's just like interesting to see mandatory return to work policies, for example, when some people are able to work from home and they're able to work from home well. And we've learned this over the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, but corporations still required this. And I think a reason why I'm pointing to the corporations want to do better is we know they're lobbying behind the scenes. So I am hoping they change their ways and can work to just be better and not just check off a box. And I definitely think hiring is an important part. And I think that also indicates why hiring disabled people to be part of the job recruitment process is also a very crucial part that companies can individually do. And the wait time for EEOC complaints needs to be expedited tremendously. That's a problem too. It's like, you don't want to wait for years an update.
That's the problem with a lot of our regulatory bodies. They've been so badly defunded and defanged that it's almost not worth, you know, going through the process. I advocate for it, but sometimes, you know, you're right. You know, it could take years to get through, which is crazy. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because I want to leave this in a place where we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
Because I think everybody should have a chance. Everybody should be a useful part of society and feel part of society. What would you want people doing? What's the activity? What's the action? And what are the marching orders in making this possible?
Yeah, I think one of the big marching orders is for people in hiring and also just in companies in general, just because you don't get an accommodation that someone needs. That's fine, but you still need to accommodate it and trust that, like, for example, you mentioned your blind friend. Your blind friend knows how to move around in the world. Just because you don't have the same experience doesn't mean that someone else doesn't know what's best for them in helping them do their job. And we should really trust and empower disabled and blind people that they know best and hire them and trust them.
Yeah, do tax credits, do incentives, does the carrot work? I'm a stick guy, but do carrots work? Mm-hmm.
I don't really think so. I think, like, I hope everything does. I'm a bit of a cynic, but partially because the ADA is even older than me. And so I'm like, oh, it's not working. But I hope things move forward. And I think another huge part of that is getting more disabled people in the position to change the law and enforcement to make it better, which is definitely possible.
No, I'm hopeful. I hope people will take a look at your article. For disabled workers, discrimination is common. If you even get to apply, written by Julia Metro. She's a fellow over at Mother Jones. Make sure you check out the website, motherjones.com. Julia, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great piece. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. I feel really old now because I remember H.W. Bush signing that ADA and thinking what a huge, huge thing that was and what a game changer it could be. Most people just think about it. We put ramps on sidewalks, but it was a major game changer for a lot of people. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. The working people. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day that President Harry S. Truman issued Executive Order 9639. It ordered the U.S. Navy to seize control of more than four dozen oil refineries across the country. As World War II was drawing to a close, workers in many industries were growing increasingly restless. They had seen company owners rake in record profits, and the workers felt they had not received their fair share. This included oil refinery workers. In August, the workers rejected a proposed settlement of their grievances over wages and hours. On September 17th, the CIO Oil Workers Union called for a strike of its 35,000 members. Although the war was ending, Truman knew oil was needed to demobilize and redeploy the troops. He used that as a basis to thwart the workers and the strike. His executive order declared that the war effort will be unduly impeded or delayed by such interruptions. He went on to state, "The Secretary of the Navy is hereby authorized and directed to take possession of the plants and facilities used in the transportation, refining, and processing of petroleum and petroleum products." Telegrams were sent to the refineries declaring that they were now under the control of the U.S. government. A third of the oil refineries in the nation came under this order. This included refineries owned by the giants of the industry, including Gulf, Shell, and Standard Oil. This was not the last time Truman attempted this tactic. He tried similar methods to intervene in labor disputes on the railroads and in the steel mills. Truman was certainly not alone. For more than a century, U.S. presidents have intervened to end strikes. From Grover Cleveland's calling out the army to end the Pullman strike in 1884, to Reagan locking out the Patco workers in 1981. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you may remember I talked about Drew Barrymore. Evidently, she got a talk show. She had it for a couple years. She said, hey, you know what? We're going to start up our talk show, even though the writers are on strike. Yeah, we're going to do it anyway. And took a lot of heat. You may remember me going on about Drew Barrymore being a scab and not this not being a good idea, something she should probably reconsider. And she did. You know, she reconsidered. She went back on her scabbery. Now that the show is about to start again, the writers, three of them, Chelsea White, Christina Kinnan, and Liz Coe, the three writers of the show who were there prior to the strike, they have turned down an offer to return to the show. And look, I don't blame them. I don't blame them at all. This is one of those things I said back as this was going on. Once you're a scab, it's hard to get that off. You know, and I told the story about, you know, moving in with my grandparents and the guy, you know, catty corner from my grandparents' house who crossed a picket line like 50 years earlier and was completely ostracized from society. I fear for Drew, and I shouldn't say fear. There's a little you deserve. We maybe need to hold some people accountable in this way. But the writers who made her show, they have said, nope, we're going somewhere else. And I think that's good. Good for them. Now you go, well, it's probably because she would have been a real royal, you know what, if they went back, possibly. Or it's just these women, these writers are standing on principle. We're not going to work for someone who is willing to stab us in the back. We're not going to work for someone who is willing to go around us. And as I said yesterday about strikes, they're relationships. At a certain point, those relationships come back together. So you don't want to do too much. You don't want to say the dreaded things or do the cardinal sin that breaks up the relationship. You know, like scabbing. Scabbing is one of those cardinal sins. So, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with Drew Barrymore. Evidently, they're looking for new writers as we speak. And look, this could be a moment where, really, I believe the reason that she canceled the show during that period of time was nobody was going to come on. A lot of guests were panicked and go, no, don't want that scab stink on me. That's on you, Drew. And I think for a lot of people, me included, the one thing that I will always remember about her is this scab moment. I don't remember the movies. I know she's in a couple, a lot. But this is now going to be probably the thing. It is what it is. Rudy Giuliani says he's not a drunk. Okay. And he's also suing Joe Biden for calling him a Russian pawn, which I got to tell you, I can't wait for the discovery. Because, you know, this is one of those things where you file a lawsuit. You've said you're not a Russian pawn. You have now come out and you've staked a flag in the ground. Biden claimed you are. You're saying you're not. Does this not open the opportunity for the Biden folks or any decent lawyer to now go through all of your life, find out where all of your money came from? Because I know where you're spending it. You're spending it on legal bills, which is why you're suing Biden, hoping you can pay your legal bills. Because, oh, by the way, you lost another lawyer in Georgia. It's gonna be him defending himself. And what's that thing about lawyers defending themselves? Something about having a fool for a client? Yep. There you go. Now, also, Hunter Biden is evidently weighing some fundraising options. Because I think they thought that, you know, the left was going to come, you know, racing in with cash because they thought that they were going to make it, you know, like it's a red hat, blue hat thing. No, Hunter Biden committed a crime. Like anybody else, commit a crime, do the time. But I guess, you know, they're saying that, you know, they thought, you know, hey, people were going to come and donate. Hasn't happened. And they're worried now that, you know, Hunter's not going to have the ability to fund a legal defense. Which, you know, this is why we have, you know, a lawyer will be appointed for you. Now, here's the weird thing. I think even a lawyer appointed for him, gonna get him off of these gun charges. Because as I've been told by a number of people, they never prosecute this as a crime. This is like an add-on that's just thrown on there just to add one more thing that they can take away. And I'm still waiting for the NRA and the gun fetish crowd to show up and defend him. I mean, they're the ones who should be defending him. But again, ideology over, I don't even know. This is politics over ideology. Very, very interesting. Now, finally, J.D. Vance. Evidently, Senator Vance has offered legislation to eliminate the electric vehicle subsidies, you know, tax breaks for, you know, U.S. buyers buying U.S.-made vehicles as part of Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. You know, because we want to promote domestic production for domestic consumption. We want to build stuff and we want to buy it. Evidently, he's going to undo those subsidies because he wants gas guzzlers. He wants to make sure that we stay with the, the gasoline engine. Now, here's the thing. This is the amazing part of this. He knows he can't do this. He knows it's going nowhere. This is what's known as a messaging bill. This is or a fundraising messaging bill. Because this is what this is about. This is about him raising money for his campaign coffers or just, hey, to line his pockets. No, Rick, you can't put that in your pocket. You can use it for any political related expenses. I know how the game works. But this is how they fleece the right. Because he's thrown out this idea that we're sticking with gas guzzlers and we're going to crush those EVs. Just send me money. It's going nowhere. It's nonsense. He knows it's nonsense. But he doesn't believe you do. Again, they just lie a little different these days. Want to hear your thoughts?
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.